Chabad Danurg Audio.
This lecture is presented by Rabbi Lezer Gurkov, Rabbi at Congregation Beth Tfilah in London, Ontario.
So welcome to our fourth and the final session on the sages of the Talmud. Today we talk about the actual people who wrote the Talmud, Rabbi Yehuda, who's known as Rabbi Yehuda the Prince. But before we get to talking about Rabbi Yehuda, we'll talk about Rabbi Meir, who primarily taught the information that Rabbi Yehuda used to write the Mishnah. So it's Sages of the Talmud, Session 4, and if I got this right, works like that. Rabbi Meir. I hope to divide this session in two, so that we'll spend about 40 minutes or so on Rabbi Meir and 40 minutes or so on Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir is one of the most enigmatic characters in the Mishnah, and by extension, the Talmud. Rabbi Meir, on the one hand, was a brilliant scholar, a scholar that all his peers recognized was at the very top of his generation. And I want to repeat that everything I share with you today comes directly from the Talmud and directly from the Mishnah. I'm prepared to give you sources if you need them afterwards. On the other hand, he was committed exclusively to the truth. And that is a very explosive combination. Someone who's brilliant but cares only for the truth. Rabbi Meir didn't care so much for what people thought or felt or whether it was the right time to speak up or wasn't the right time to speak up. If Rabbi Meir thought he was doing the right thing, then that's what he did. If he felt that this was the right opinion, then that's the opinion he took. Rabbi Meir didn't care much for public opinion. Rabbi Meir was committed exclusively only to the truth. He was a very handsome fellow as well. And that plays a role in the next part of the presentation, which is Rabbi Meir's wife, Bruria. But before we get to his wife, let's talk a little bit about his background. What's his ancestry, his family? Where does he come from? The Talmud tells us something very interesting. Of the many generals that Rome sent against Israel during the Great War, there was one general by the name of Nero, not to be confused with Nero the emperor, but Nero, a general, who had second thoughts before he actually made it to Israel, and said to himself, the God of Israel wants to destroy his house, namely the temple, and then wants to dry his hands on me, because he was certain, of course, that the destroyers of the Jewish land will themselves be destroyed. So the Talmud says that he abandoned his post and that he found some Jewish community somewhere, surely not in Israel, and converted. And that Rabbi Meir was one of his descendants, whether it was a grandchild or a great-grandchild. So Rabbi Meir does not come from one of the old, illustrious Jewish families. He is a recent newcomer to the Jewish people. But his ancestor, or whether it was his grandfather, we don't know exactly, whether it was a father or a great-grandfather or a grandfather, was obviously a man of great conviction. His teachers were the greatest teachers of the generation preceding him, Rabbi Akiva, of whom we discussed at length last week, and Rabbi Yishmael, who we did not have an opportunity to discuss, but he was Rabbi Akiva's colleague. Rabbi Meir was ordained by Rabbi Akiva in his young age, but refused to accept that ordination. He felt he was too young and not really prepared. You have to realize that during that time, our rabbis did whatever they could to ordain the promising students because they didn't know how long they would be in place. And smicha, ordination, depends directly on an unbroken chain that leads straight back to Moshe. So if I would be the representative of Semicha in my generation, I would want to ordain as many promising students as I can before such time as I would, God forbid, be executed, arrested, or whatnot. This was an uncertain time. So Rabbi Akiva ordained Rabbi Meir, recognizing the promise in this young man. But Rabbi Meir felt that he was too young at that point and not well-versed enough. So at an older age, Rabbi Meir was ordained by another scholar who held smicha during that time, by the name of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. I want to tell you a little bit about the second ordination. The Talmud tells about this ordination, and it was done under fire, with great heroism, by Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was an elderly man, maybe in his 80s, and he invited five students to come with him to a predetermined area outside in the desert, probably the Judean desert. The Talmud describes it between a big rock place. The bottom line is they were between a rock and a hard place, figuratively as well. And Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba proceeds with the ordination, and from afar, the Roman legions were making their way to this hidden area. Someone obviously had let the word out. There was a very narrow entrance into this area between the big rocks. Rabbi Yehuda said to the youngsters, he said, run and save your lives. And they said, Rabbi, come with us. And he said, no, I've lived my life. You're the future. I'll hold them back. So Rabbi Yehuda stood in the narrow entranceway with his back to the oncoming soldiers while he gave the youngsters an opportunity to flee. And when they saw him standing there, they paused, obviously again giving another chance for escape. And when they realized what he was doing, the Talmud says that they emptied 300 arrows into his back, and that's how he died. This was Rabbi Meir's second ordination. So Rabbi Yehuda literally gave his life to keep the chain of smicha alive. And by doing that, by ordaining these five individuals, they were able to in turn ordain the next generation and kept the smicha chain going until the middle of the fifth century. The middle of the fourth century. It was in the early, about 420 or so, when the last ordained rabbi passed away. Bruria was Reb Meir's wife, and Bruria was an exceptional woman, one of the few women that the Talmud not only notes, but also quotes. The Talmud says that Bruria was a very wise woman. She would study 300 laws every day during the course of her studies, and there were times that she disagreed with some of the rabbis, and the greater Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, in fact, who would be the one who ordained Bruria's wife, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba, ruled in accordance with Bruria's opinion. There were times that she rebuked the scholars of her day. There's a story of Rabbi Yossi Haglili who approached her and asked her for directions, and she rebuked him because, don't you know that your colleagues have said it's inappropriate to speak to your colleague's wife like that? And so she was obviously speaking tongue-in-cheek, saying, when it's okay for you, you're prepared to ask me for directions, but otherwise it's not okay to talk to your colleague's wife. So Bruria was a feisty woman. She was a beautiful woman. There were times that Rabbi Meir asked her to speak for him, to substitute him as the lecturer. And she stood behind a partition because of her incredible beauty. Rabbi Meir was concerned about tempting the students at the academy. She was a compassionate woman. The Talmud tells a story that one day Rabbi Meir was taunted by his neighbors. And he was quite upset by these continuous taunts. And so he wanted to pray to God that he just do away with these neighbors of mine. And we'll see soon that Rabbi Meir's prayers were listened to in heaven. So Bruria quickly stepped in and said, no, remember that in the book of Tehillim, David HaMelech writes in chapter 27, Yitamu chataim, may the sins come to an end. He didn't say, may the sinners come to an end. Chataim, lo chotim. So why don't you rather pray to God that they have a change of heart? And Rabbi Meir did that instead. She was a strong woman. She overcame incredible tragedy, not only overcoming her own tragedies, but helping her husband overcome the tragedies of their family. So Reb Meir and Bruria, a handsome and beautiful, brilliant and wise to beyond measure in their generation, recognized as such by their peers, lived a life surrounded by incredible tragedy. And that's not to say that they were the exception in that generation. It's almost like speaking of the generation of the Holocaust. Not that one wants to compare one suffering to another, but it's not out of the ordinary that a Jew from from Europe during the 40s should come back and say that they've lost most of their family. And that was par for the course during the 40s in Europe. It was par for the course in Israel during the beginning of the second century, especially during the purges that took place after the crushing of the Bar Kokhba revolt, which is when Reb Meir and Bruria lived. So here is a list of some of the tragedies that Bruria herself experienced. Her father was burnt at the stake because he taught Torah in public after Hadrian forbid public dissemination of Torah. Her father was burnt at the stake. The Talmud describes an incredibly moving story of how her father had a Torah with him in his pocket. And when his student said, what will happen, what will be, he said, you need not worry for me. As long as the Torah is with me, I'll be protected. And then, he didn't mean physically protected. He meant his immortality would be protected. And then when the flames began to lick at his feet, they said to him, Rabbi, what do you see? And he said those very famous words, I see that the parchment is burning while the letters are dancing in the air. Otiyot porchot ba'avir. The letters are dancing in the air. This is, in a sense, he was proclaiming the immortality of the Torah's message, the immortality of the Jewish spirit. You might take the life, the body of this particular leader, of this particular scholar, but the Torah's message and the Jewish spirit lives on, perseveres, because the parchment can burn, but the letters will dance in the air. When they asked him, how dare you transgress our laws, violate our laws, and teach the Torah in public, his response was succinct. He said, because I'm fulfilling the dictate of the greater king, that is the king in heaven. In fact, he was rebuked by his own colleagues when he went to visit Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma. Rabbi Yossi said to him, don't you know that the evil power is in place? They have taken many of our wonderful leaders and many of members of our nation, and still they're in power. Why do you play with your life? And Reb Hananya said, if God wants me to die, I'll die, and if he wants me to live, I'll live. So Reb Yossi was more of a diplomat, and at his funeral, the great nobility of Rome came to eulogize him. Reb Hananya was more of a firebrand, and at his funeral, the executioners of Rome looked simply to kill him. But speaking of his executioner, he overheard the students ask Reb Hananya, and again we're a little bit off of the topic talking about Reb Meir's father-in-law, Bruria's father. The student said to him, why don't you open your mouth and let the flames enter, and that will hasten your death and lessen your suffering. And Reb Hananya said, it's not to us to end our life quicker. Every moment of life is a gift. So the executioner overheard this and asked, if I help by removing some of the wool from your chest and increasing the flames of the fire, will you promise a shear in the world to come for me? And Reb Hananya permitted it. And so that's exactly what the executioner did. And recognizing that he himself would be punished for this act, he jumped into the fires and died with Reb Hananya at that moment. And so the assumption, of course, is that Reb Hananya and the executioner entered the Garden of Eden, the world to come together. This becomes an interesting question when we talk about end-of-life issues and whether it's permissible to hasten the end of life, because Reb Hananya was obviously hesitant to end his own life, but he wasn't averse to allowing a executioner to end his own life. And of course the question becomes whether we can derive a halachic conclusion from an agadic story. But that's the story of Reb Hananya ben Trajon, Bruria's father. Her mother, Reb Hananya's wife, was burnt at the stake along with her husband just because you were his wife and supported his actions. Now, in their sadistic, cruel method of punishment, they decided that they not only wanted to harm Reb Hananya and his wife, but also to destroy their spirit. And they did that by taking one of their daughters, Bruria's sister, taking her prisoner, but not just prisoner, they pressed her into service in a house of ill repute. And so she was a beautiful woman, as we know Bruria was a beautiful woman, and his sister was as well. And so she had quite a clientele that was interested in her, and we'll learn about her fate soon. But that was even more crushing to her parents, that not only was their life being taken, their daughter was being pressed into such an immoral type of service. And she had it says sons here in the plural, that's a mistake, it should say son. One son that died, oh, I'm sorry, brother, I'm not brother. A brother that was murdered simply by a group of bandits, and he was murdered yet when Reb Hananya and his wife were alive, so they buried their son before they themselves were taken, so Bruria lost a brother. And then on top of that, she lost two sons at a very young age who simply died. And the Talmud tells this story as well, it's a well-known story. That in the middle of Shabbos afternoon, the sons came home with a headache. She put them to sleep and they died in their sleep. Rabbi Meir, who spent most of his Shabbos afternoons and Friday evenings, as we shall soon see, giving a sermon at the synagogue, when he came home Shabbos evening, he said to her, where are my sons? And she said to him, Rabbi. She called him at that point, my rabbi. And even though she really viewed him as her equal in Torah scholarship, she said, my rabbi, let's make Havdalah first. And then after Havdalah, he said, Banai Eifohem, where are my sons? And she said, Rabbi, Yeshli She'ela, I have a question. Someone gave me something for safekeeping, and now he has come to collect it. Am I required to return it? And he said, well, of course you are. So she took him by the hand, or the Talmud doesn't quite say she took him by the hand. That's an intimacy that we don't usually share in public. But she walked with him to the bedroom, and she said, here is the item that we've been called upon to return. We've been given for safekeeping and called upon to return. And she pulled back the covers, and Reb Meir saw his two sons lying there dead. And Reb Meir broke down in tears, and the Talmud describes it in a moving fashion, and he said, Banai, Banai, my children, my sons, my sons. And there is his beautiful wife standing beside him, surely with tears pouring down her cheeks, and yet standing there and telling him, but this is the item we've been called upon to return. Hashem natan v'Hashem lakach, God has given and God has taken. And in fact, this has become one of the many verses that we say in the Tzadok Hadin, which is the prayer that is said over the open grave just before we fill the grave at a funeral, at a Jewish funeral. Some of the other verses that we read in that prayer were in fact proclaimed by her father and her mother and her sister during the time of their own sentencing. And so in fact, the prayer that we recite during Jewish funerals reflects the story of Bruria, the wife of Reb Meir. To move forward, faith and courage. Bruria fought her way back. By hook or by crook, she managed to make her way back into some form of healthy living. She made sure to save her sister. She turned to her husband and said, here is a bundle of golden coins. Take it and find a way to save my sister. So Reb Meir makes his way out to this house of ill repute. There's that famous story about two Jewish women that are living in an apartment across the street from such a home. And they see the minister walking down the street, looking right and left. No one's around, so he walks into this house. And this old Jewish bubby says to her friend, he says, ah, it's a shame to see a man of the cloth go bad like that. And then a few days later, there's a Catholic priest walking down, furtively looking right and left. No one's there. He walks in, and again, these Jewish ladies saying, ah, what a shame to see a man of the cloth go bad like that. And then the next day, they see their own rabbi walking down the street, looking right and left, walking into the house. She turns to her friend and says, ha, one of the girls must be deathly ill. Reb Meir walking into a house of ill repute. You can imagine what that's like. He's a famous rabbi with many students, and he's found himself a house of ill repute. But he decided in his own mind that if she had maintained her purity, and she has not allowed herself to be corrupted, then she will be worthy of a miracle. But if not, there's no way I can help her. I know that God won't intervene if she willingly compromised herself. Not if she had no choice and was raped, but if she willingly compromised herself. So Reb Meir disguised himself, and he found her house, and he found her room, and he propositioned her. So she told him, I can't, it's not the right time of the month. So he said to her, I'll wait a few days. And so she told him, there are others here in this house that are far more beautiful than I am. So he figured that she's maintained her purity to the extent that she was able to, even in this immoral house. So he went to talk to the proprietor of the house. And he said to him, here is a basket of coins, and please take as much of it as you like, and it'll help you pay off or bribe whoever you need to bribe so that I can take my sister-in-law home with me. So the proprietor correctly said, that's all fine and good until I finished using the bribes, but once I use up the coins, who will protect me then? So here is an example of Reb Meir's incredible, not only bravery, but also faith in God. Reb Meir says to the man, I'll give you a sentence of three words. You say those three words, whatever calamity might fall upon you will be miraculously reversed. He says, what are the words? Elaka de Meir Anena. The God of Meir, answer me. Not God of Israel, not God of Abraham, God of Meir. Right? Meir, he's the man who's exclusively dedicated to the truth. If God's going to help me, it don't have to invoke the name of Abraham. Invoke my own name. He's my God too. So the man says, that's fine and good. How do I know it'll work? So there were some man-eating dogs in the corner there for protection. And so Reb Meir said, sick your dogs against me and I'll show you. And so the dogs come to attack Reb Meir, and he stands there unflinchingly and says, Alakah de Meir, Anena! And the dogs simply cower in the corner. So the man says, fine, that seems to work. Take your sister-in-law and go. So as soon as she leaves and the Romans get wind of it, they immediately arrest the proprietor and put him up on the executioner's block. He says, Alakah de Meir, Anena, and the rope tears and he falls down. So they're shocked. They said, where did you get this powerful sentence? So he told them the story. So they know Reb Meir. And so they started chasing Reb Meir. And they actually found him. And the Talmud tells us three versions of what might have happened. Obviously, the story then grew him a beard and some pious as well. So we're not really certain which of the three versions actually occurred. But the Talmud tells the following three versions. One is Reb Meir immediately found another house of ill repute and ran in there and said, I can't be Reb Meir. Do you think you can catch Reb Meir in a house like this? And they said, no, of course we wouldn't. Another version is that he saw a woman and he walked up to her and he threw his arms around her. And he said, I can't be Reb Meir. You think you'd catch Reb Meir in a compromising position like this? And they said, no, of course not. And the third version, which is most interesting, is that he walked up to a group of people that were sitting around having lunch, and there was a big pot cooking, and he put his finger in the pot, and he licked his finger, and he said, you can't expect Reb Meir to eat non-kosher. And in fact, he put in one finger and licked the other, a sleight of hand. And so that's how he got away from them, but he was forced to flee the country. Because to save his life, at least for a while, Reb Meir had to flee the country. So he saved his sister-in-law, but Broria lost her husband for a little bit. So she saves her sister with the story of God of Meir. She overcame all of her tragedies, the loss of her sons, the loss of her parents, the loss of her brother, and of course the story with her sister, but not her personal shame. There was one point where Reb Meir said to her, I really feel that the students are beginning to develop feelings for you, and it's really appropriate for you to stop lecturing. And so she took offense. You are questioning my integrity. And in fact, there was one student who did in fact have a crush on her, and they did have an affair. And despite the fact that Reb Meir assured her that he was aware of it, and on that night he actually replaced the student, it was him rather than the student that she was sleeping with, she wouldn't accept his words. And she took her life. She committed suicide out of shame. She wouldn't simply say, because in fact I ended up sleeping with my husband. She simply said that I am very ashamed of the fact that I, Bruria, the one who was so sure of herself, ended up succumbing to these temptations. And so she could not overcome her own shame. She was able to overcome her grief, but not her personal shame. And in his misery, Reb Meir, who loved her dearly, once again left the country in shame, left the country in solitude, and left the country in mourning, a man literally without a family. We will see later that he did have a daughter who married a person who was obviously a Torah scholar, because he's quoted at least once in the Talmud as the son-in-law of Rabbi Meir. So that's the background of Rabbi Meir's family and Rabbi Meir's personal life. Now, as a scholar, he was, as we mentioned, brilliant. It was Reb Meir who disseminated the teachings of Rabbi Akiva, and it was those teachings that later were used by Rabbi Yehuda for the writing and the editing of the Mishnah. And so as a result, whenever there is a teaching in the Mishnah that is not attributed to anyone else, we assume it's Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir's name is only quoted in the Mishnah when there is a dispute between Rabbi Meir and someone else. And in that case, we are required to know who disputes the other person. So Rabbi Meir's name, even so, is quoted in the Mishnah more than 300 times. And then all the other laws that are brought in the Mishnah that are non-attributed are also, as we understand, in the name of Rabbi Meir. In his generation already, it was said that Reb Meir was so wise that surely his opinion should always have carried the day. The problem was, no one could understand a word he was saying. He was too deep. And he was so complex that he can argue both sides of the coin. He could convince you that something was kosher, and after you were fully convinced, he can convince you that it was in fact not kosher. And you never knew which way he stood. Because he understood the matter so deeply, so fundamentally, that he can argue both sides of the coin, just like that. He loved the debate. And because of that, it was impossible to truly follow Rav Meir's opinion in the halacha because no one understood it. One obligation you have as a Torah scholar is when you vote your opinion in the halacha in a setting of a Sanhedrin or a Bet Din where you have to offer your vote, well, you have to vote your understanding, not your teacher's understanding. If you don't understand your teacher, and you know he's brilliant, but you didn't get it, you have a different understanding, then you have a moral obligation to vote your own mind, not your teacher's mind. And that's why Rav Meir was so frequently outvoted. It was described that if you saw Rav Meir in the Beth Midrash in the study academy, it would be comparable to seeing someone uprooting two mountains and grinding them one against the other. That's how complex he was with his theories and his analysis, as if he's grinding two conflicting theories one against the other, and in the end comes out with something clear, at least to him. In later generations, they refer to Rav Meir as Peh Kadosh, the holy mouth. When you speak of someone holy, generally you speak of someone who you don't understand. So you just say, ah, a holy person. Later, Rabbi Yossi said of Rabbi Meir, he is a holy man, a great man, and a modest man. He had a student by the name of Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon. Sorry, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Elazar ben Shimon was his colleague. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. And Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar said of Rabbi Meir, just holding his walking stick made me wise. In other words, just being around him was an incredibly enriching experience. By osmosis alone, you could learn so much. And Rabbi Yehuda, who we will learn of soon, who was not a great fan of Rav Meir personally for reasons we will soon see, nevertheless, when he was asked, what made you so sharp? He said, it was the fact that I attended several of Rav Meir's lectures, but I saw him only from behind, because Rabbi Yehuda was a youngster when he attended Rav Meir's academy, and so Rabbi Yehuda was only permitted to stand in the back rows, where he can only see the lecturer from behind. Had I seen his face, had I been able to communicate with him face to face, I would have been even sharper. So the great scholars of the following generation attributed in great compliments to Rav Meir, and surely his own peers did as well. The fellow who said that he can argue both sides of the coin and convince us was a colleague of Rav Meir. Rav Meir made his living as a Torah scribe. He was an expert scribe. In fact, so expert that one day he went to Asia Minor. He was a visitor in Asia Minor quite frequently. Asia Minor, primarily we suppose that most of his travels were in the area we know today as Turkey. So at one point he was there during Purim, and there were no Megillahs in that area, so he wrote his own, but he wrote it by memory. And the Talmud has a whole discussion, because you're not permitted to write any book of Torah by memory. You have to quote, you have to have an open book before you, and then write word by word from the open text. And so they said, Rav Meir is an exception because his memory is so robust. And finally they concluded that even Rav Meir should not have done it unless it was an emergency situation such as his was, because there was simply were no other Megillah to read on Purim. So he was able to write the whole thing simply off memory. He used a special ingredient in his ink so that it wouldn't erase. He was worried that if it takes 30, 40 seconds for the ink to dry, during that time a fly might land in the ink and then ruin the form or the shape of the letter, thus making it unfit to be used until it was repaired. So he put a special ingredient in the ink to ensure that the ink could not be erased. But his teachers later told him that that wasn't appropriate, that ink should be pure, not mixed in with other ingredients. Rabbi Yishmael, who I mentioned was one of his teachers, said to him, Bini, my son, ma malachtecha, what is your work? What is your vocation? So he said, Sofer, lavler ani, I am a scribe. Lavler is Aramaic. And so he said to him, Bini, my son, have a zahir bimalachtecha, be very careful in your work. Shemalachtecha melecha shemayim, for you perform the work of heaven. And if you add a letter, or you miss a letter, you can literally destroy worlds. because the strength of our people and our the fact that we've preserved our tradition is based on the purity and the integrity of the transmission of Torah from generation to generation. If a scribe should make a mistake, then that can result in misunderstandings and, in fact, faulty formulation of law in further generation. For his work, Rav Meir earned 3 sela a day. Being one of the expert scribes of the generation, he only worked enough so that he can earn 3 sela. A sela is a denomination of those days. What did he do with his 3 sela? He spent 1 on food and drink, another on clothing, and a 3rd he distributed to the scholars of his day. And so his student said to him, "What about your children? Won't you leave anything for them?" And here's typical Rav Meir speak. Rav Meir says, "If my children will be righteous, then lo ra'iti tzadik ne'ezav. I've never seen God abandon a righteous person. And if they won't be righteous, why should I leave my money to the enemies of God?" There's Rav Meir speaking to you. So he would spend his 3 sela every day, and the next day he would write a little more and earn a little more. And with all of his extra time, he basically spent it studying Torah. Despite his brilliance, the sages were very hesitant to quote him by name. I've told you that his name is quoted more than 300 times in the Mishnah, and still it is often, his work is often attributed to acherim, to others. So let's say Rabbi Yehuda said the following. Others said something else. And he was called others for 2 reasons. And the first is that he followed Elisha. Elisha ben Avuya was a very famous scholar, a colleague of Rabbi Akiva and all of the greats of that generation, of Rabbi Meir's teachers, and he turned heretic. With all of the suffering, the incredible suffering of that generation, he could not reconcile a good God with such cruel suffering. And so he turned against, and he became a heretic. And we have many such examples of people that have come through the Holocaust and have come to such conclusions, but this is unique in the sense that this was a great scholar of Torah. He knew all the answers, supposedly, and yet turned against Torah. And so all of his colleagues abandoned him, and Rav Meir kept studying with him and learning from him. So the Talmud tells us that one day Rav Meir was teaching on Shabbos afternoon. I told you before that Rav Meir spent his Shabbos afternoons expounding to the masses. And he saw Elisha riding on a horse outdoors. Now, you know, we don't ride horses on Shabbos. Jews don't even ride horses on Monday. And so he leaves the whole audience behind and he runs to greet his teacher. And he walks along with his teacher. Reb Meir, one of the greatest sages of his generation, walking alongside his teacher, who's violating the laws of Shabbos. You can imagine that did not gain him votes of popularity. But Reb Meir was exclusively dedicated to the truth. There was teaching of Torah here, and he was determined to glean those teachings from this individual, from Elisha. Well, Elisha is, in fact, quoted in the Mishnah as well. Well, anyway, in this discussion that is documented both in the Midrash as well as in the Talmud, Elisha says to Rav Meir, "What have you been teaching?" So Rav Meir says to him, "I taught that Tov Reshit Davar Me'achrito. Tov Achrit Davar Me'reshito." A quote from the book of Iyov, from the book of Job. "The end of a thing is better than its beginning." And Elisha says, "What did you teach about that?" And he said, "Well, I taught that it is possible for a person to study Torah in his youth, forget the Torah he studied, and turn back to it in his elder years." And Elisha said, "That's not what your rabbi taught. Your rabbi taught it is better for someone to learn in his later years, it is better that a person who learns in his later years has continuously learned the Torah and never turned away from it any point in between." The unspoken message here was Rav Meir says to his teacher, "Even though you've turned away, you can still turn back." And his teacher says, "No, but it still won't be as good as if I had never turned away." So his teacher says to him, "What else did you teach today?" He says, "I taught from the book of Isaiah, from Yeshayahu, that you cannot compare the Torah to gold or crystal." "What did you say about that verse?" Rav Meir says, "I said that even though the Torah is so difficult to acquire as it is difficult to acquire gold, it is easy to lose it, as easy as it is to crush or to crack a bowl of crystal." So, in other words, "Rabbi, I know you lost it. Don't think anyone blames you. It's easy to lose it. But it's going to be hard to come back. It's still possible." Elisha says, no, that's not what your teacher said. Rabbi Akiva said, because Rabbi Meir also learned from Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva said that although it is easy to break gold and silver, it is still possible to repair it. Ah, said Rav Meir, so then if it's possible to repair, then Chazor Bach, return. Why don't you return as well? But before Rav Meir had a chance to say that, Elisha said to him, Rav Meir, you're reaching the outer limit of the range that a Jew is permitted to walk on Shabbos outside of the city. Rav Meir said, how do you know this? So he says, because I've been counting the steps of my horse. So Rav Meir said, while we're discussing, you still have the presence of mind to count. You're such a wise man. Turn back to the Torah. He says, Meir, I told you, turn back to your house. For me, it's too late to turn back. One day, he says, I was riding my horse behind a shul on Yom Kippur. And I heard a voice come from heaven saying, all Jews are welcome to turn back except for Elisha. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's too late. Well, when Elisha when he became sick and was on his deathbed, Rav Meir came to visit him. Again, you can imagine, was probably the only Torah scholar who was loyal enough to come to visit Elisha. And he said to him, Rabbi Chazor Bach, please return back to the Torah, your last moments. And he said to him, even until now, is it not too late? And so Rav Meir said in the Tehillim, it says, Tashev Enosh Ad Daka, a man can return until Daka. And Rav Meir expounded, Ad Dichtucha Shel Nefesh, till the soul is pressed, oppressed and ready to leave. So Elisha broke down into tears and he died. And Rav Meir was happy, saying, I'm sure that my master died out of teshuva, out of repentance. However, after Elisha was buried, someone came to tell Rav Meir that a great flame had descended and was burning Elisha's grave. So Rav Meir ran out to the cemetery, he took off his cloak and he covered the grave and extinguished the fire. And then Rav Meir quoted the verse from Ruth, and again here you see the same Meir that speaks about Elikah de Meir, the God of Meir. In the book of Ruth, where Boaz says to his cousin, where Boaz says to Ruth, Im yigalcha, if your cousin will redeem you, meaning if your cousin will marry you, to, very good, yigal, let him marry you. The imlav, but if he won't marry you, anochi agalcha, I will marry you, I will redeem you. So Rav Meir said that to God and to Elisha. He said, Im yigalcha tov, if the good one, if God, who is good to all of his creatures, tov Hashem lakol, God is good to everyone, if tov will redeem you, then yigal, let him redeem you. Being low, but if God does not want to redeem you, if God of heaven and earth says, Elisha is not welcome in my garden, Anochi Agalcha, I will redeem you, Elisha, fear not, I, Meir, will stand up against God and ensure your redemption. And Rav Meir taught that on Shabbos, when there's a fire in a house and you have to grab the Torah to save the Torah from destruction, you're permitted to grab the Torah's cover as well. You don't have to undress the cover of the Torah and let it burn. You take the Torah with its cover. So if Elisha is the cover that contains Torah knowledge, then of course Elisha should be saved along with the Torah. And so Talmud tells in a different area, different section, what I just told you from the Midrash in the book of Ruth, but in the Talmud, in the tractate of Chagiga, we are told that the fire was extinguished and the sages said, he is not even in purgatory. He's not even in Gehenna. Because if you go into Gehenna, it's a preparation to enter into Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. And he's not even at that stage. Rav Meir said, when I die, I will ensure that my master is allowed at least to begin to burn in the fires of Gehenna so that he can prepare to exit from there into the Garden of Eden, to Gan Eden. After Rav Meir died, a flame descended and burnt over Elisha's grave, and the sages took it as a sign that indeed, Anochi Agalcha, I redeemed you. But Rabbi Yochanan in the later generation said, what is this, a great favor to do, to put your teacher in the fire? When I die, I will drag him out of Gehenna and force his way into Gan Eden. And indeed, when Rabbi Yochanan died, the fire over the grave of Elisha was extinguished, and the eulogizer said, even the angels guarding the door of the Gehenna couldn't stop you from entering and dragging out Elisha. They spoke of Rabbi Yochanan in that way. Whether there was a physical flame over the fire or not as a material, this is just the discussion that the rabbis had about the destiny of Elisha posthumously. So in the end, Elisha, according to our rabbi's understanding, did receive entry into the Gan Eden. So I explained to you that Reb Meir's justification was that the cover of the Torah should be permitted to enter with the Torah. And there is another metaphor that the Talmud uses about the fruit, the pomegranate specifically. Rabbi Bar Shilas was a very pious man who often, the Talmud tells us, had discussions with Elijah, Eliyahu HaNavi. And so Eliyahu HaNavi appeared to Rabbi and said to him, what is God doing at the moment? And so Eliyahu said, God is quoting all the rabbis of the current generation, but he refuses to quote Reb Meir. And so he asked him, why won't he quote Reb Meir? Because Reb Meir learned from Elisha. He says, but wait a second, Reb Meir found a pomegranate, he ate the fruit, and he threw out the peel. Tocho achal klipa zarak. So Eliyahu said, God just heard you. Currently, Reb Meir, hear God saying in Gan Eden, Meir bin Yomer, he's quoting, Meir, my son says, because he heard your defense of Meir and he accepted it. Well, nevertheless, it sounds that Reb Meir was a person that would always walk his own route, travel his own path, but when it came to his own decisions in life, he wouldn't defy his colleagues. Reb Meir and his colleagues had an argument about mixing a medical concoction to help with a particular ailment on Shabbos, and it required the mixing of wine and of oil. And Reb Meir said, wine and oil are both regular edible foods, and to mix it for medicinal purposes is permissible, even though there's a rabbinical prohibition against mixing a medical concoction, despite the fact that this is for a medicinal purpose. And his colleagues disagreed. And Reb Meir at one point had that very ailment. And you recall that Reb Meir had a student by the name of Reb Shimon ben Elazar, the one who said that holding Reb Meir's stick was itself an enlightening experience. So Reb Shimon said, I'd like to prepare this concoction for you, Rabbi. And he said, no, the thought has never crossed my mind to defy the ruling of my colleagues. My ruling is to permit it. But I won't permit it for myself. And so they said, even if your life is endangered. And he said, yes, even if my life is endangered, I will go with the majority vote, not with my minority opinion. So despite his brilliance and his commitment to the truth, he was also committed to the halacha and the majority vote of the law. I've mentioned a number of times that Reb Meir spent his Shabbos day speaking to the masses. Now Reb Meir, as we said, was a great brilliant exponent of the law, to the point that his brilliant colleagues couldn't keep up with him, but he also had the gift of the gab and can speak and appeal to the masses, and he divided his time into three. A third of his time he studied the halacha, and a third of the time he studied the agada, the exposition of the works of Torah, expounding upon the works of Torah, and then finally, parables. He told beautiful parables, great stories, and the sages tell us he had 300 parables about a fox, of only three of which have been preserved in the Talmud. And so the masses flocked to hear his stories. And it says in the Talmud, in fact, that when Reb Meir died, the parable spinners died with him. He was the last great teller of parables. And he was a great attraction on a Shabbos afternoon or even a Friday night, as reflected in the last story on this screen, Spit in My Eye. One day, a woman came home late at night on Friday night. Where was she? She was studying with Reb Meir. And again, you can understand here, and I add this just for color, I don't know if this is a fact, but Reb Meir was a handsome man, and maybe the husband was not only upset to be left at home alone watching the kids, but also a little upset that maybe his wife was enjoying her time with this very handsome Reb Meir. So he said to her, you can't come into the house until you spit in Reb Meir's eye. Well, she'd never considered doing a thing like that, spit in the rabbi's eye. Reb Meir heard about it, and he came over to her one day and he said, listen, I've got this little thing in my eye. If you can please do me a favor and spit in it 7 times just to wash my eye out, please. She says, Rabbi, I'd never do a thing like that. He said, I beg you, please, can't you have a little rachmanis, some pity upon an old man? So she spit in his eye 7 times, and he said to her, go home and tell your husband, I did what you've asked me to do, and I did it 7 times over. So his student said, Rabbi, if you don't care about your own honor, what about the Torah? People will start demeaning the Torah that you've studied. And he said, and God doesn't care about his own honor? And isn't there a time when God has instructed that the writing of his own name be erased in order to restore good relations between a husband and her wife in a situation where a suspicion has fallen upon the woman? And so he said, if God can do that to his name, Meir can do that to his eyes. Rav Meir was a man of peace. And there are a number of stories in the Talmud that demonstrate that. He once came to a city where there was a long-standing feud. And he stayed for 3 weeks until he could resolve the feud. And the Satan, the Satan, later complained to God, Rav Meir drove me out of my home. He drove me out of my residence. I loved that place. It was wonderful for me. I could roost there. And Rav Meir drove me out. Rav Meir is the one who gives us the description of Aaron's efforts to make peace. His methods were, when he saw two people in a dispute, he would approach one and say, I'm sure that your antagonist would be happy to make peace with you if only he knew that you were prepared to make peace as well. And then he would return to the first one and tell him the same story. And when he secured agreement on both ends that if the other one was prepared to forgive, then I'm prepared to forgive, then he would bring them both together. It's a good guess to make that if we speculate that Rav Meir used those kinds of methods in resolving the dispute that took him 3 weeks, but which he stayed with it and succeeded in the end. There was a dispute between Rav Meir and his colleague Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda said that when we fulfill God's will, then he views us as his children. But when we turn from him, he no longer views us as children. Rav Meir said, Lo, bein kach u bein kach, atem kruim banim. This way or that way, whether we fulfill his will or transgress, God views us as his children. His view of the Jewish people was a positive one. Rav Meir was a very pious man. I mentioned he had a daughter. His daughter was probably as beautiful as was his wife and his sister-in-law. And so he said all the time, beware, don't leave me alone with my daughter because I might be tempted. And this is Rav Meir who always mocked the sinners of his neighborhood, saying, I'm never prepared to succumb to my temptation, so why do you? And I told a similar story last week of Rabbi Akiva. One day the Yetzer Hara disguised itself as a beautiful prostitute sitting across the river. So beautiful and so attractive that even Rav Meir couldn't overcome that temptation, and he started wading across the river. And when he got halfway across, Rav Meir said, the evil inclination revealed itself as the spirit that it was rather than the guise of the prostitute, and said to Rav Meir, if I hadn't just heard in heaven, beware of Rav Meir and of the power of his Torah, I would have allowed you to succumb to your own temptation. So never mock another person who wasn't able to overcome his temptations. We mentioned before that Rav Meir's daughter married a Torah scholar. This individual is referred to in the Talmud as Chatan Rav Meir, the son-in-law of Rav Meir. Rav Meir traveled broadly. At one point, Rabbi Akiva, who was also a seasoned traveler, saw a ship go down, and he knew Rav Meir was on the ship. And he said he mourned the loss of his student. But then when he got to a country by the name of Kapotkia, and I don't know what country that might have been, Rav Meir appeared before him. And he said, Meir, how did you survive? And he said, well, one wave passed me over to the next wave, and in the end, I got deposited on the shore. So he was miraculously saved. And the Talmud tells an interesting story about Rav Meir and his colleagues, Rav Yehuda and Rav Yossi, that were traveling. And they reached a place, and Rav Meir didn't trust the host. He thought the innkeeper. Rav Meir had a sense that he wasn't to be trustworthy. So Rav Meir took his money wallet, his money bag, and he hid it in the cemetery. And Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi deposited their money with the innkeeper. Well, the next morning, the innkeeper comes to Rav Meir and says, I had a dream last night. My father came to me and said, in the cemetery where I'm buried, you can find a money bag. So Rav Meir said, don't trust dreams. Dreams are just foolish anyway. They're silly. And then Rav Meir quickly went to the cemetery. It was Shabbos, so he stayed with his money bag till the evening. And then when it was dark, he grabbed his money bag and walked home to find his colleagues in a dispute with the innkeeper. They're saying, give us our money back. And he says, I never took money from you. And Rav Meir saying, aha, why didn't you trust me? So the next day, they invited the innkeeper for a drink in the tavern. And after he was already in his drink-induced slumber, they went back to the inn, and they had noticed during the course of their drinking that the tavern keeper had traces of beet on his mouth. So they went to the innkeeper's wife and said, "Your husband told us that you should give back the money that he hid. And just to make certain that you know that he really gave us this message, he gave us a sign that only you and he know. This morning for breakfast you had beets." And so she gave the money back. The Talmud tells us, from here you see, you always have to fulfill the rabbinic dictum to wash your hands and your mouth before you conclude your meal, the mayim achronim. Otherwise, you see what might happen. So, that's the story of the dishonest host. The Talmud also tells us that Rav Meir had an interchange with Cleopatra, and she asked him whether when the Mashiach comes and the dead are revived, will they be clothed or not? And Rav Meir said, if when you plant a kernel of wheat, you plant it unclothed, and then it sprouts in many garments. So, of course, when you bury a person, you bury him in many garments, or her in many garments, and so when these individuals will be revived and with the coming of the Mashiach, they'll come back to life and clothed in their garments. So, obviously, Cleopatra never made it to Israel. Rav Meir made a journey out to where he met her. Toward the end of his life, the Sanhedrin, the high Jewish court, convened in Usha. And Rav Meir, for the first time in his life, was given an official position. He was called the Chacham. And that was the third in the hierarchy. At the very top was the Nasi, and that was Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, the descendant of Hillel. And then Rav Natan was appointed the Av Bet Din, the Supreme Justice. And Rav Meir was appointed Chacham. At one point, Rav Meir and Rav Natan were dissatisfied with Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's methodology, and they decided they wanted to dethrone him or depose him. How would they do that? There is a obscure section in the Talmud that rarely any scholar ever studies. And they felt that if they can just prepare that section of the Talmud very well and ask questions the next day, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel would not be equipped to answer the questions because he hadn't really prepared it very well recently. It wouldn't be fresh in his mind. And so they'd be able to demonstrate that this leader of the generation is not really worthy, because only one who really knows all of the Torah should lead the generation. But one of Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's loyal supporters, whose name was Rav Yaakov, overheard the plot. So rather than tell Rav Shimon ben Gamliel what had happened, our sages are far more subtle than that, he sat down next to Rav Shimon's apartment and started studying this text loudly. Rav Shimon got the message, and he thought, there's some reason why Rav Yaakov wants me to study this text, and he spent the night preparing the text. And the next day, he defended himself ably, very well. And then he called Rav Meir and Rav Natan in, and he said, I understand what you attempted to do, now I understand it, and because you did that, I'm going to kick you out of the study hall. So you can't enter, I'm taking away your permission to enter the study hall. So Rav Meir and Rav Natan were sitting in the corridor outside, writing little questions and sending them in. And these were questions of such brilliance that no one could answer the questions. And so when no one answered the question, they wrote the answers and sent them in. So Rav Yossi, who always remained Rav Meir's friend, said, what's going on? The Torah is outside and we're inside. Torah mi bachutz, ta'anu mi bifnim. And so that night, Rav Natan and Rav Meir both had a dream in which they were told that it would be a good idea to go and reconciliate with Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Rav Natan went ahead and trusted his dream, and he reconciliated. And Rav Meir said, nah, dreams are silly anyway. I'm not going to do a thing like that. Rav Meir felt he did the right thing. Why should he apologize? I'm not apologizing to anyone. I'm dedicated only to the truth, and it was right. I should have deposed Rav Shimon. And the fact that it didn't work was just a shame, and I'm not going to apologize. So at that point, they said again that Rav Meir's quotation should come by the name of Acherim, others say, rather than Rav Meir's name himself. And Rav Meir had to leave the country again in isolation and in shame. Finally, I want to explain that when Rav Meir passed away, he was in Turkey, and he asked to be buried next to the water that connects Turkey and Israel, so at least the waters of Israel will lap over my grave. Then he also asked that his remains be carried at the first opportunity to be buried in Israel. And one of the great mystics in the 16th century, the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, identified Rav Meir's grave in Tiberias, where we today claim the grave that everybody visits of Rav Meir is in Tiberias, and that was identified by Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, who identified many graves in his day. Over the years, the memory of the precise location of graves were lost, and he identified them mystically. Rav Meir is known today as Rav Meir Baal Hanes, Rav Meir the man of miracles, And the reason he's known that way is because of that story of Elikah de Meir Anena, God of Meir, please answer. And there's a tradition that Rav Meir said that if anybody gives to charity for the Jews in Israel and he does so in my name, I will pray for that person. And hence, charities that collect on behalf of Jews in Israel, especially Jews in Yerushalayim, go by the name of Tzedakah, the charity of Rav Meir Baal Hanes. After Rav Meir passed away, Rav Yehuda, who in fact was the son of this Rav Shimon ben Gamliel that Rav Meir tried to depose, Rav Yehuda was teaching his own son, whose name was Shimon as well, teaching Rav Meir's Torah. And he said to him, Acherim omrim, others say. So the Shimon said to his father, Rav Yehuda, Mihuzeh, who is this? Shemeima vanushosin, that we drink his water, but Shmoei nanu maskirim, but we don't mention his name. So Rav Meir said, this is the person who tried to uproot the honor of your father's household. So he said, but they've all gone already. My grandfather, may he rest in peace, is gone. And Rav Meir, may he rest in peace, is gone. It's time to bury the hatchet. So Rav Yehuda agreed and he said, Mishum Rav Meir Omrim. They say in Rav Meir's name. He wasn't yet prepared to completely forgive, but he was prepared at least to mention Rav Meir's name. Rav Meir's colleague was Rav Yehuda. And Rav Yehuda did not want to accept Rav Meir's students in his academy after Rav Meir passed away. He said, Kantorim him, they are antagonistic. They're not here to learn. They're here just to prove their points. And so he refused to let his Rav Meir's students in. So Rav Yossi, who was Rav Meir's other colleague, I mentioned his name on a few occasions, he said, Yehuda Koes, Yehuda's angry. Meir is dead. And Yossi Shosik, Yossi is silent. Torah Matahei Aleh, what will be with the Torah? And so he prevailed upon Rabbi Yehuda to let Rabbi Meir's students into the academy. And just to give you an idea who Rabbi Meir's student was, a man by the name of Sumchus, who made 49 arguments to the positive, and another 49 arguments to the negative, following in Rabbi Meir's brilliant footsteps. And of course, Rabbi Yehuda didn't feel like having such a contrarian student in his yeshiva. And Sumchus remains one of the most highest regarded names in all of the Talmud.